You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the 19th of March, 2025. And this is a topic that I've only mentioned in passing in the past. But the topic is very simple. Why nobody in the Middle East likes the Kurds? And there's very good reasons for this. People who are my age may remember a time, starting in 1990, possibly that summer, a very strange and obscure group was suddenly front page news. This was entirely an unknown group in the West, the Kurds, that we were told was a victim of horrid persecution from the Turks and the Iraqis, specifically from Saddam Hussein. And from then on, there's been a general bias in their favor, and that's been the norm in the Western world. And their claims of mass persecution and gassing, which of course has no foundation, in fact, from Saddam Hussein. But the assumption is all of this is true and had no justification. But as always, the facts are quite different, especially when it comes to the main military body, and really the main political body, of the Kurdish movement, which is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. And there's a great naivete about them. Maybe it's decreased a little bit, but the bias in their favor remains very strong. Technically, it still registers a terrorist organization by the State Department. But despite what people may tell you, that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with policy. Even the news agencies won't label it that. And they have, thanks to the Israelis, a tremendous capacity for public relations. There's a tremendous ideological presence of them in the Western world, and they even claim to represent the Kurdish people. They do not. As far as I know, instead of improving the situation, their misdeeds, their misconduct, always creates new problems or worsened problems that already existed. So I want to take aim at these general biases. Now, I'm not going to make any ethnic claim here whatsoever. I'm not making any claim that there is or is not a Kurdish nation, how distinct they might be from the Turks. That's not my concern. It's enough for me to say, and it's hard to be a nationalist and reject it, but it's enough for me to say that presumably a majority of those calling themselves Kurds subjectively see themselves as substantially distinct from Turks, and hence they deserve an independent state. Whether or not there's an independent or objective basis for this is not my concern, and frankly, I don't have the expertise in that area. But whether they like it or not, PKK is the dominant organization and has many offshoots. They're always changing their names, and there's good reasons for this. We'll get into here in a minute. PKK is a Marxist-Leninist group founded in 1978 that sought, or at least says, it seeks an independent Kurdistan, which would be a very substantial country. It would have to take away territory from Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria, which is part of the reason why it could never happen. Now, for years, for decades, Turkey denied that the Kurds were ever a separate ethnic group, although that is no longer Turkey's official doctrine. But wherever they have any great numbers and form their political movements, they have caused destruction and confusion. They have very few friends in the Mideast. If they are distinct ethnos, then they certainly deserve a state of their own. But their militant representatives have made it almost impossible to sympathize with them. They are a perpetual irritant in the Middle East. Now, when I mention the PKK, I'm talking about the general leftist militancy that goes by various names in different countries around the Middle East. But the PKK is the de facto leader of the Kurdish national movement. It is an obnoxious and violent poison in the area. And not surprisingly, it is favored by the Israelis and, of course, long financed by the United States. The PKK label is known in Turkey. It's the PJD in Syria, the PCDK in Iraq, or the Democratic Solution Party, and the Kurdistan Free Life Party in Iran. So when I say PKK, I'm covering them all. And especially in Syria, they've changed their names a few times. Actually, I've talked about that on this show. And that has to do with American aid. If one group is labeled a certain way, they could change their name and that goes away. Terrorism, that is to say, these violent actions targeting civilians for the sake of a political end it can't gain any other way, that's been the norm for them. But that has nothing to do with them being romanticized beyond belief by the Americans at both mainstream parties. A search for its leadership will prove this. For almost 50 years, these terrorist attacks have gained nothing. Since the 1980s, they became so obnoxious that they were almost internationally recognized as a terrorist organization. They've killed roughly 50,000 people. But this is no different from the KLA, you know, Kosovo Liberation Army. All these irregular militias that are allied with the U.S. Most of the carnage, actually, the victims of them have been Kurds, usually Kurds that don't go along with things. They recruit children in both Syria and Turkey, starting with at least the first war against Saddam's Iraq in 1990, where they thought that they had carte blanche, and they did. They have a very strong, very wealthy, organized crime mafia involved in the drug trade and human trafficking, and it's loosely allied with all other Kurdish militant groups presently fighting in Syria. The Turks are correct to fight them. The leader of this group, many of you may know, Abdullah Öcalan, also its founder. If you search for him, even just on YouTube, you'll see the romanticization of this guy. He's an avowed Marxist and a feminist, and in so doing, he's maneuvered himself to being the darling of the faculty left throughout the world. He doesn't really speak Kurdish. I mean, he was raised Turkish with the Turkish language, so he speaks Kurdish with an accent. But it was in 1999, he was finally captured by the special forces of Turkey and brought to trial. Prior to that, he had a training camp functioning in Syria that led to the Assad government eventually throwing him out. But he was tried. He was sentenced to death. But in order to please the EU, the Turkish government, or the Turkish courts, changed that to the life in prison. He's still alive, and he still functions today in prison. Of course, like all of these kind of things, the court's verdict against him was immediately condemned by the entire Western world. But since then, there's many offshoots. This organization, they changed its ideology for public consumption, and, of course, are regularly supported and financed by the Western world, especially the United States. When it was founded, you had this series of military coups in Turkey, partially designed to offset the extreme violence that groups like the PKK and the left in general had had created. But even in the 1960s, the life of the Kurds in Turkey was continuously improving. And that military government fell in 1973. You had a development of Kurdish universities, a revival of their cultural institutions, much of this financed by the state. But when you have a violent organization or movement, even prior to the PKK, you know, these, and going right into the 2000s, the constant improvement of Kurdish life was met by just more violence. because official accommodation, they really have a tough time dealing with that. They don't benefit the Kurdish cause, such as it is. They went from Maoist to Stalinist to anarchist, which is weird for a group like that. But they clearly have nothing but contempt for their own people. The moderates, people like Mehmet Bukak, he was murdered in 1979. The Kurdistan Socialist Party was destroyed by the PKK because they had a tendency to be more moderate about these things. People advocating autonomy or for cultural rights. Many of them were murdered. From 1978 to 1980, the PKK assassinated 354 public figures and failed to assassinate about 366, severely wounded. And they were all Kurds. They were all Kurds of some prominence. But there was never, in the 70s and 80s, there was never any persecution against the Kurds as such. The prime minister and eventually president, Turgut Özal, was the minister of economic affairs from 80 to 82, prime minister in 83, and he became president of Turkey in 1989. He is a Kurd. Now, it should be noted that the PKK was dependent on Soviet money, but that just meant that the Soviets saw the Kurds as a tool against Turkey, against NATO. Today, it's a tool of NATO and the Israelis. You had both substantial improvements, the economic and legal life. You know, the Kurdish parties in Turkey are legal. You had a Kurd at the head of the government for a long time. But the PKK's response was their first great terror offensive in 1984. Civilian targets became even more of a priority in 1987. From 87 to 2002, the exact tally is 5,335 civilians murdered, including 96 teachers killed because they were teaching in the Turkish language in areas where they were Kurds. The Workers' Party in this period demolished 114 schools and 6 hospitals, heavily damaged another 127 schools and 8 more hospitals throughout the 1980s, partially because they were built by the state. There was even dissent within the PKK itself. Even today, they will tell you that the Turkish state persecutes them, something still taught in the U.S. But the main obstacle to economic development, I mean, Kurdistan is quite undeveloped, is the PKK itself and this mentality. They profited from the region's underdevelopment. They have done absolutely nothing, and many of these groups are like that. There was a local official in 1984 in Sweden in the PKK who left the group, said, "I can't take this anymore," and he was murdered. In 1988, and Sweden became one of the first to ban the organization. A spokesman for the PKK in Europe, Hussein Yildirim, broke with them, saying that the massacres of innocent people, he couldn't defend it. He did survive. The Germans closed the PKK offices on its soil. A group of German tourists were then massacred in Turkey in 1993. When President Özal tried to ensure the future of Kurdistan in 1992, that's when their second terror campaign began. And that was right after the Turks officially recognized Kurds as a distinct ethnicity and ended all restrictions on the language. It's almost as if the point was to poison relations. If relations got too close, they would do something crazy and any kind of trust would be destroyed. The PKK was engaged in conscription. They weren't a particularly popular movement. Elected mayors in many Kurdish towns were murdered by them because they were recognized by the Turkish state. But you had, by the beginning of the 90s, under the Özal presidency, you had many Kurdish associations created by the state. And the more this occurred, the more they targeted civilians, especially Kurds that helped the government in these things. You had another wave of reforms in favor of the Kurds from 2001 to 2004, and that, again, was followed by another wave of attacks. Now, their propaganda, and many in the Western press will tell you that they only target the police and the military, but that's another lie. Now, killing these guys in an ambush outside of combat, that's not excusable either. That's a problem just by itself, whether or not they're in uniform. But it doesn't matter because the PKK never limited themselves to the security forces. Between 2006 and 2007, the group burned many shops owned by Turkish traders in France, Germany, Switzerland, and Finland. And the only reason that they did it was to poison relations between the two groups. And this was all over the place, in Germany and in France. But things changed in 1990. When the Iraqis invaded Kuwait, the Kurds suddenly appeared in a very different light. This is why they had the Israeli PR. The claim was that many of you remember that Saddam Hussein had gassed thousands of them for some reason. Actually, it was in 1988, Halabja. He was depicted as a new Hitler almost every day. I distinctly remember this. He needed to be stopped. And every major news source at the time, in these pre-internet days, repeated this claim using some variation of the words I just said, without, as always, a shred of criticism. But of course, there was very little evidence for this, like a lot of the claims made against Saddam Hussein at the time. I came across an article by Robin Miller in 2003 from Dissident Voice. It's the CIA's October 2002 dossier, Iraq's Weapons of Mass Destruction Program, identifies only 10 instances of reported Iraqi use of chemical weapons, and none of these were directed specifically at the Kurds. All occurred during the Iran-Iraq War. 7 were directed only against Iranians, and in 3 cases, including the one in Halabja, the victims included both Iranians and Kurds, which supported Iraq's contention that it used mustard gas only in military operations against Iran. The CIA claims only 20,000 casualties, both dead and wounded, in the alleged campaign against the Kurds, as opposed to Human Rights Watch's assertion of 50,000 to 100,000 deaths. And given the tendency of the U.S. government's desire to magnify the claims of Saddam's criminality, the CIA's estimates should be interpreted as the maximum possible figures. But the CIA then later denies this. It's acting against their own interests, and it carries great weight. Human Rights Watch was the one who published the initial report that fed the media machine. I've read it. I read it many years ago. I read it recently. It's a very poorly written, very hastily written set of assumptions and rushed conclusions. They offer no solid evidence for mass gassing and rely almost entirely on Kurdish refugees in Turkey. Saddam Hussein did not commit genocide, and his rule, productive in certain areas, was almost always taken up by warfare. They were killed, Kurds killed there in March of 1988, but they were caught between the Iranian and the Iraqi forces during what was a very needless war, one that was partially financed by the Israelis. They were collateral victims, if anything. They were never targeted. But the mass gassing claims were huge back then. It's part of the American propaganda buildup to the attack on Iraq in 1990, leading to this long drawn out war between the two countries that only recently ended. Originally, it was called Operation Desert Shield, sometime in 1990, later upgraded to Desert Storm. And the allegation was it was to liberate Kuwait from Iraq, but it almost did. It did only serve Israeli interests. And these claims are still being made, regardless of the total lack of evidence. Like Gaddafi, Hussein needed to be murdered, so as to ensure that these lines could never be exposed. But again, this was before the internet, and like almost everything concerning the Middle East that was promoted in the Western press at the time, it was a carefully crafted lie. The PKK's ideology is vaguely Marxist, although it does claim otherwise today. The Turkish Kurdistan movement kind of modified their brand of socialism to include it. Öcalan's ideology is always changing. It depends on the political environment. He has to be a leftist or else he would be rejected by the regime, so he always maintained his university faculty lounge-style leftism. He came out of the student movements of the mid-1970s, along with Soviet money. Öcalan was influenced by a man by the name of Mahir Kayan, who was a more normal Marxist-Leninist, despite the fact that Kurdistan had probably no working class. He founded the People's Liberation Army in 1970. Immediately engaged in terror throughout Turkey. And until martial law was imposed in 1971, these leftists were involved in bank robberies and kidnappings. They kidnapped 4 American Air Force officers, who survives, by the way, but this is completely forgotten, in 1971, and four NATO technicians a year later, who were all murdered. It's amazing how all that was swept under the rug, largely because they were leftists, but partially because they supported the Israeli agenda as far as Saddam Hussein was concerned. The only thing the U.S. did was condemn the Turkish military actions against them afterward. Kayhan is considered a social reformer, for those few people who know anything about him in the academy. Now, they robbed banks. They even murdered the Israeli consul general in Istanbul, Ephraim Elrom, in 1971 by that same party, because they were part of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Even that was swept under the rug. But Öcalan, who was a follower of his, took your typical, you know, dinosaur-style Leninism and added the Kurdistan issue to it. It isn't like you saw this in the Third World. It's a little different than that, partially because, you know, the Ottoman Empire was a colonizer. It was not colonized. But this was the initial framework that justified their terror actions. Either it's Marxism or Kurdish nationalism or something like that. But the only thing they've ever done is destroy what existed at the local economy. And the only thing they really brought in was American university grants. The nature of these kidnappings and murders and targeting civilians, it destroys whatever credibility they ever have. That all of these pseudo-intellectual, you know, long-term people's war strategy or legitimate defense strategy, armed propaganda, and all this nonsense, which I think mostly was aimed at an American audience. The democratic political struggle. But, of course, you know, none of that was ever done. Depending on the situation, they would stress either, you know, a Marxist aspect or a nationalist aspect, no matter what. But later on, Öcalan claimed to be, of all people, inspired by Murray Bookchin, the Jewish-American left anarchist, which is a very odd person to go to. Clearly, he's aiming at an American audience. So now the regime says that, well, the PKK has abandoned its terror for the Marxist and Leninist revolution. Now they're just a communalist, followers of Bookchin. Well, it just so happens that yours truly has read Bookchin in some detail. And I'm not sure how any of his plans, as vague as they are, could ever be established except by violence, especially in Kurdistan. Öcalan also has stressed environmentalism, which is very convenient. It's been trendy in the West since the late 1980s. He uses a lot of abstractions, direct democracy. You know, Bookchin was into municipalism. Somehow that was a replacement for anarchism. I guess unless the votes didn't go his way, which is pretty, you know, it's interesting because, it, you know, there's not a whole lot of places where there's any place with a high Kurdish majority, or at least not without pluralities of others. But it's striking how unpopular groups always are the loudest in speaking about abstract direct democracy. And you see this with the Jacobins, the PKK, Red Army. You see this all over the place. But Bookchin was opposed to ethnic nationalism. His views are entirely inappropriate for a war-torn area. Of course, it's all theater. It's a series of slogans designed to appeal to pseudo-intellectual journalists and the academy. Öcalan is a lawyer, or at least he went to law school. But ultimately, the purpose is to, by violence, unify the Kurds in Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria. At least those that he hasn't murdered or extorted yet. He now claims that he wants to unite all of these Kurds in a single administration in a, quote, non-hierarchical and democratic administration. Of course, one that the PKK will control with an iron fist. But again, this is rhetoric. It's aimed at a very naive American audience. And that's to permit, and it's actually worked, it permits American academics and journalists to claim that since they have undergone this ideological transformation, they should be removed from the terrorism list. But the problem is, their tactics haven't changed whatsoever. Once in a while, they'll use, despite being an atheist group, they'll use Islam as a source of motivation. In the 2000s, they tried to do this. Öcalan in 2013, he called for a Democratic Islamic Congress to convene in Diyarbakir. Just completely cynical. He wanted to control his own variety of the religion more congenial to his interests. And it makes sense given the time period, 2013, the start of the war in Syria, the rise of the Islamic militancy there. But in 2014, he had this, I don't know how, he's doing all this from prison. I don't know how bad his imprisonment could be. But he said that, quote, there is a constant need for a new Islamic institution in Kurdistan and the rest of the Islamic world. And he claims this authority. That should tell you what he really is. Something tells me that who financed this Congress worked for USAID. Coming from that, although this actually predates their Islamic phase, suicide bombings. It's not every day you come across a secular or even an atheist organization that masters a suicide bombing. It's usually an Islamic group thing, or usually an Islamic group in the pay of the Israelis or the Americans. The fourth conference of the PKK in 1996, they already had a suicide option already in motion. And they began, I think the first one was in June of 1996. They used a female suicide bomber, Zeynep Kanasi, detonated the explosives that she had strapped to herself during a military flag-raising ceremony. Killed 8 soldiers and wounded 29. I guess if it was a female bomber, it makes it a progressive murder. If you go through the PKK leadership publications, including Öcalan's, you'll see a lot of feminist stuff there. This is somehow very important to him. So the suicide bombers have to be female. They have their so-called special forces, the Kurdistan Freedom Falcons, who deliberately goes to, you know, these bazaars in different districts in Ankara, explicitly to kill civilians and using suicide bombers, then of course car bombing too, but none of this ever deterred American financing. They're able to use an offshoot or change their name, and that's how they can, you know, they're always being supported in one way or another, even if it's just indirectly. They did this all the time. In 1 year, 2015 to 2016, they carried out 11 suicide bombing using cars, someone in a car. And yet, as all this was going on, just a few years later, the parliaments of Australia and the UK tried to get the PKK removed from the terrorism designation, the Atlantic Council, the New Republic. The same goes for EU, Sweden and Finland. If anything, the PKK strategy just led them to become more or less discriminate in their choice of target. Making matters worse, they have a fairly substantial international organized crime syndicate. Racketeering, drug trafficking. I mean, not everything's going to be financed by the USAID and Pentagon. You had like the Greeks and Cyprus were providing support to the PKK, along with the United States, any enemy of the Turks at the time. You had a bunch of sentences in 2000 in Paris, extorting Kurdish businessmen there at the time. A huge investigation by the judge, Thierry Fragnoli, who apparently is French, exposed an entire Kurdish extortion ring aimed at their own shopkeepers in the area. And they were even using this investigation exposed the use of like semi-Islamic slogans to manipulate young Kurds, which is something that both the Turks and the British had uncovered. The cult of abduction, you know, abuse sexually, torture into compliance at a young age. I mean, after all, they're for the sexual revolution. But some of you may have heard, despite all of this, just a few days ago, in fact, the PKK... Öcalan out of jail, or from jail, declared an immediate ceasefire with Turkey. Now, he does this all the time. But then he said, I want you to lay down your arms and dissolve, which, to say the least, stretches credulity. Now, he's called for this before. He said the same thing in 2023. He said it again in 1993. And all of a sudden, now he claims to respect national borders and wants just regular political work, not the armed struggle. Democratic reforms, he says. He does this stuff all the time. he knows that Western journalists are very easy to manipulate. Since that he's a leftist, he knows that this kind of rhetoric would lead to immediate praise, and he was right. Evren Balta wrote, it was in a Turkish publication, he said, "For those observing the issue from within Turkey, this turning point was deeply perplexing. Key leaders of the Kurdish political movement, including its most popular figure, remained behind bars. In 2024 and 2025, the Turkish government appointed trustees to replace elected mayors from the pro-Kurdish People's Democracy and Equality Party and the Republican People's Party, following arrests on terrorism charges. This practice impacted Kurdish-populated municipalities all over the place. The Kurdish opposition also faced a large-scale crackdown. Concerns over Turkey's democracy had reached their peak as discussions on the Kurdish issue were gaining momentum." This is when he decides to... It doesn't make any sense. Not to mention the fact that Kurdish forces are in a war in Syria, made, you know, far more intense after the fall of Assad. It seems like a bad time to dissolve. Well, it's just empty rhetoric. It's something that's done is permit the group to take another name and to disappear from the list of promoters of terrorism. They have a bunch of front groups all over the place. The Syrian version is the YPG. They have many affiliate groups throughout the Mideast. I don't have the feeling that the U.S. had everything to do with this announcement. In the meantime, Erdogan looks like a hero. And I think, well, the proof for this is fuzzy right now, it might be tied with his release from prison. And yes, there's crackdown on terrorism because this is a terrorist movement. They don't do this out of nowhere. Kurdistan is always going to be a huge problem in the area. Any place that you have a Kurdish majority, and there's not that many of them, you have huge minorities. And in Syria, the Kurdish Nationalist Party, which is just the military wing, is the YPG, another PKK offshoot, declared a federal Kurdish state. It doesn't even have a Kurdish majority. But even if it did, it wouldn't matter. It'd have huge minorities anyway. This area, Hasankaya province, has Assyrian Christians, Armenians, Turkmen, Arabs. Only 40% of its roughly 2 million people are Kurds. In fact, you have areas of this province that have fewer than 15%. And this is common all over the place. So, if this is the agenda, you declare an area where you're not even a majority, Kurdistan, or a part of Kurdistan. And it shouldn't shock anybody that the PYD and the YPG are engaged now in ethnic cleansing of the non-Kurdish minorities. And they're not shy about it. And this is what happens when you're supported by the U.S. So Leah Muslim, the head of the PYD, declared this. In fact, he declared this as early as 2014, once the war started. He said, "One day those Arabs who have been brought to the Kurdish areas will have to be expelled." He said this on Serik TV. Over the last 10 years, that has not abated. Now, it's going to be much easier than before without the threat of Assad hanging over them. In just a few years, you had about 20,000 Arab villagers who were cleansed from the area. And since the fall of Assad, it's only grown in intensity. And this happens elsewhere. The YPG is doing the exact same thing as the PKK, murder, property confiscation, and Kurds that don't want to go along there either drafted or worse. The YPG's formal policy is to loot and confiscate property. They want to repopulate any of the Assyrian villages with Kurds, and that goes back to 2016. Neocons and Zionists have always been backers of the Kurdish cause. And back in 1990, they saw their window. One of the leaders of this was Daniel Pipes, one of the historians who's a neocon. He claims that he converted, this wasn't that long ago, to the cause of an independent Kurdistan to be based on the foundation of the autonomous zone that exists, that has existed in northern Iraq since the early 90s. He claims that he doubted it, and it was feasible for a long time. But He said, I don't believe he ever doubted it at all. But here's what he said. This is not that long ago. He said, what if Iraqi Kurds in the autonomous zone join forces across three borders, as they've done on occasion, and form the single Kurdistan with a population of like 30 million and with possibly a corridor to the Mediterranean? And he has this map very pompously, this huge state now. And he says very offhandedly, which is going to be created by dismembering its four neighbors, all of which, by the way, are opponents of Israel. I'm not sure how he thinks this is going to happen. It has to either be Americans, who do not have the power to do this, or terrorism. And of course, even if somehow this were done, it would generate a massive civil war. But in Pipe's mind, that's the point. The slaughter of millions in the neocon mentality, and of course, unfortunately, Trump is a part of this, is perfectly normal. He's just parroting Tel Aviv in this sense. And then he says, and he said since then, he said, well, secession of the Kurds, quote, would helpfully diminish that arch-aggressive mini-empire. And of course, he means Iran. He wants this for Turkey as well. Of course, the Turks have been more assertive in their condemnation of the Israelis. And all of this would only serve one group. It wouldn't serve the Kurds. It could only serve the Israelis. But this autonomous region, the IKR, near the Iranian border, northern Iraq, of course, both the Iraqis, who want nothing to do with the U.S., and the Iranians want this dismantled. This goes back to Desert Shield. It was installed by them once Saddam was under attack. The Kurds then carved out this zone, which still exists. And it's a source of agreement, but some friction between Iraq and Iran. And of course, they're right to say that the U.S. and the Israelis created this and continue to support it. The terrorist groups, of course, being the PKK and ISIS, both the creations of the West, being given logistics, finance, intelligence by Mossad in the U.S., all for the same purpose. And, you know, as the American combat readiness continues to fall, the U.S. is going to more and more have to rely on these proxies. I came across an article from 2017 from Michael Goldfarb in the Jewish Forward, who comes out and says that it had been an open secret for a long time that the Kurdish movement and Zionism, especially the Mossad, had been very close for a long time. There was the independence referendum not that long ago, and he says Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was alone among world leaders when he endorsed the Kurds preparing to vote in this referendum. But that was a rare public declaration of this secret closeness. Israeli-Kurdish friendship is a geopolitical love that dares not speak its name, for the Kurds would prefer to keep it quiet. And he claims that it's been taboo for a long time, and of course, that's true. This goes back to the days of Ben-Gurion, that he wanted to keep the Kurdish, a very close Israeli-Kurdish relationship secret. But then, you know, Ben-Gurion actually assigned the Mossad to handle the situation. This goes back decades now. And as always, the goal was to dismember their Arab opponents, which he says would be seen as an act of aggression. Yes, that would be seen as an act of aggression. But that's not obvious anymore. And it dares not speak its name because it would give the game away. It would expose the Kurdish movement for what it really is. The Iranians have said this over and over again. The Kurdish cause is the creation of the West and of Israel, whatever its objective rights are. Mossad created their first modern fighters, were the first to support their claims against the Arab states, as well as the Soviet Union, by the way, who financed them. They worked together in this respect. The referendum I mentioned was in Iraq, formally endorsed by Netanyahu, which irritated the Turks, which is a very bad idea now. So the Kurdish issue at root is a Zionist one. There's very good reasons for the fact that the Kurds have no friends in the Middle East other than the Israelis. And that is people who have actually regular experience with them. The autonomous region of northern Iraq is the closest you have to an independent Kurdistan. It's a political and economic disaster. So you have like this de facto independent state from, say, 1991 onward, the only part of the economy, other than drugs, is this one oil pipeline. And it comes from stolen Syrian oil. That's the whole economy. Now, proponents of the independent Kurdistan idea claim that the PKK was instrumental in defeating ISIS back in 2016. There's a guy stupid enough to make this claim, Jonathan Tobin, writing for the National Review. He even goes so far as to deny that Russia and the Syrian army were at the center of the war on Daesh, ISIS, the American entity. Of course, no evidence. And he does it just to romanticize the Kurds. He has no understanding of the region, at least no understanding that doesn't come out of the New York Times or the State Department press releases. He even believes in his stupidity. Maybe it's a studied stupidity, but Kurdistan will be a beacon for democracy in the region, regardless of, if not its history of failure, but its present existence. But these vapid claims, these illogical and stupid arguments, suggest that there's far deeper reasons behind these this stupidity. But it's not that hard to unearth. The autonomous region was, the IKR was founded in 1992. It is completely bankrupt. $30 billion in debt, which for them is a huge amount of money. That's about 5 years of their annual budget. They don't say who this debt is owed to, whoever is controlling the oil coming from Syria. So it's either the Israelis or the Americans or banks close to them. It's like in Ukraine or Kosovo. Their claims for independence are just window dressing. It's all about foreign control. But the region's deficit is completely out of control. Even non-petroleum revenues, they have a huge income. Their income is double what Jordan has. And yet the economy is at like Ukraine levels. Now, of course, it's pure corruption, but this is all stolen oil. The oil is stolen from Syria. It's sold at 100% profit. And Israel is very dependent on this. And it's sold to Israel, Italy, France, Greece. It's a secretive trading system. Payments are up front. Israel buys its oil from the center of the IKR, Erbil. It's so inexpensive. Well, it's inexpensive because it's stolen. It's free. It's a scam, especially made easier with the fall of Assad. 40% of Israel's oil imports are from this area. Went up 100% from last year. 80% of its crude oil came from Iraqi Kurdistan in 2015. Of course, the entire thing is stolen. It was Mossad who negotiated this deal, was facilitated by the U.S. And it's very strange that in this, you know, backward, out of the way, you know, this autonomous region in northern Iraq, you have one of the biggest American consulate general buildings outside of the U.S. Embassies normally are under the State Department, but the one there is under the Pentagon. It became a consulate general in 2011 when the war began in Syria. The same thing goes for the embassy in Baghdad. These are huge complexes. There's 30 consulates in the IKR, 6 honorary consulates, 6 foreign trade offices. The Iranian general, Hussein Rajabi, he said, you know, in a part of the world like this, 30 consulates? That doesn't make any sense. It's just, these are listening points. This is espionage. A tiny, totally non-independent and broke region. It's not really a country. Gets this level of attention? Iran very rightly views these as outposts for any future attack on Iran. The U.S. invaded and destroyed Iraq, starting in 1990, ending in 2020. It actually was thrown out of Iraq in 2020. It used its ISIS creation to serve as its proxy afterwards, but that was only defeated by the Russians and the Syrian army, along with, well, I should say, with Iraqi irregulars. Yet the U.S. tried to pretend that it was their victory over ISIS, that's why they even tried to claim that COVID was the reason for their withdrawal. Now, in fact, the Iraqi parliament threw them out because they financed ISIS. In fact, even more specifically, the prime minister at the time ordered the Americans out after they murdered Mushtaq al-Jawahiri in Baghdad, one of the main Iraqi commanders who was central in the defeat of ISIS, and as a result of that, became an enemy of the Americans. Another enemy of ISIS the U.S. murdered was General Qasem Soleimani in 2020, if you remember. So, yeah, the Iranians attacked the Al-Asad air base in western Iraq with 12 missiles that were sent and hit the base. It was deliberately so as not to kill anybody. There was no casualties, so the Air Force had to run around. Okay, what injuries can we report? So they decided that everyone that was there at the time claims they have a concussion. That was a big injury. So now, if you look at the Wikipedia article, it says, created hundreds of traumatic brain injuries, an attack. No one was killed, but the whole thing is a scam. But the people in the Middle East who are aware that both ISIS and the Kurdish movement are creations of the U.S. is everybody. That's the list. Everybody, except, of course, the Israelis. So this Kurdistan, it comes from the SDF in northeast Syria, another PKK front, financed also by the U.S. and the Israelis. The Americans actually occupy the largest oil field. That's what produces the stolen oil. They kept it from Assad. He wanted to use it to provide electricity to the population. And it was in 2023, a convoy of 44 tankers carrying stolen oil clandestinely to American bases in the IKR. It's very much like a mafia-style thing. The Kurds then made a huge profit. The American forces also took 95 tankers and truckloads of stolen Syrian wheat to the Kurds, which was part of the American starvation policy against Syria. What was left of the Syrian wheat fields were torched by the U.S. Army and Kurdish militias. But frankly, that kind of thing is the only way that the autonomous zone, Kurdistan, could survive. The commander of the SDF is Malzum Kobani, also a member of the PKK. His real name is Ferhat Sahin, one of Turkey's most wanted terrorists. He actually works for the Pentagon. He is in charge, been put in charge of security for the stolen Syrian oil and its tanker transport. So the entire Kurdish movement, no matter what they may say, revolves around the PKK and its connection with the Pentagon and Mossad. But this had severe implications. Not only does it show the Kurdish autonomous region to be just a mafia front that's impoverished, and they're just pocketing that money, but sanctions this the theft of this oil. You know, Syria was never a huge oil producer, but it was $100 billion in the first few years. Well, from 2010 to 2015, losses in that sector. Of course, it affected mostly civilians. The main field is Al-Omar in Syria, taken by the Americans. The fact is that near the end of the Syrian government, they were getting about an hour's worth of power a day. And this is a country that was headed towards first world status just, you know, in 2010. But those seeking an independent Kurdistan, they know what a war with Turkey would be. They seem to think that it would be an American victory. You know, I've been saying this for a long time, but just the other day, the United States Air Force was forced to admit that just over half its air fleet is capable of flying. It used to be even more of that for naval aviation. I don't know if it still is, but most of the American warplanes don't fly. Either they don't have the pilot, or it's in no condition to fly. In Britain, of course, it's even worse because there's a massive pilot shortage because of their diversity initiatives. They refuse to hire or to promote white pilots. So even in the air, the U.S. and NATO do not dominate. And what does function, this goes for naval assets too, is totally overworked. Any war with a regular army, especially something like the battle-hardened Turks, would be a total defeat for the Americans. But it also means that groups like the PKK, the Ukrainian military, all of these things, these proxies are essential to the functioning of the American empire. And nothing's new about this, right? The PKK financed itself. This, you know, it was a NATO, actually, a report, Reinforced Economic Committee meeting in 2007. Narcotics was the PKK's most profitable enterprise. But this seems to be common Among these irregular forces in the American camp are the Chechens, the KLA, the Ukrainian militias, the militias in Burma, the forces of northern Afghanistan. They were all part of the drug trade. As you know, the one leader who destroyed the drug trade, the former president of the Philippines, they want to now arrest him for this. And, of course, the Taliban, who won their drug war in about a month. I mean, the KLA was almost entirely financed by it. But NATO also had to admit that the second most profitable enterprise of the PKK is human trafficking. Again, very similar to the Kosovo Liberation Army. And in order to pull this off, you have to have a massive propaganda and fundraising network. In Europe, they have 2 news agencies, 4 television stations, 13 radio stations, 10 newspapers, 19 periodicals. So it's not a shock. I mean, since Kurds are the allies of the Israelis and the Americans, they can do whatever they want. This is why they receive American protection in Europe. There's even a connection with Antifa. For years, members of Antifa have joined the YPG. They received armed training, of course, with no legal ramifications. Hundreds of foreigners, in fact, since 2014, traveled to northern Syria to at least either join or train with the YPG, relying on its PR machinery, etc. They thought they were fighting terrorism and being, you know, edgy. They returned to the U.S. from Syria without any hindrance, starting with the Obama administration on. None were ever investigated, showing what Antifa is and showing what the Kurds are. It's very clear what's happening here. Antifa wants seasoned combat veterans. Just one more piece of evidence that Antifa is a part of the regime and serves as a Kurdish link to American domestic policy. There's a reason that all the countries where there's a sizable Kurdish population in the Middle East hate the Kurds. It's a universal constant. Places like the Kurdish Autonomous Region is a parasite. Everything is dependent on, you know, on support from the outside, just like Ukraine is. The existence of this independent Kurdistan nonsense is to fight Saddam Hussein for the Israelis and to serve as a proxy for the Americans against whoever irritates it. And they're going to watch themselves when it comes to Turkey. PKK, or whatever it becomes, whatever name it's going to take in the future, they're a criminal mafia group, just like the KLA. And when you have regime, you have entire parliaments wanting to remove them from the list of terrorist entities, and then this latest stunt last week where he wants to disband themselves, you realize what political theater this all is and what the Kurdish national movement really is. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.